Hi everyone, welcome to the Unhandled Exception podcast. I'm Dan Clark and this is episode number 12. And this evening I'm joined by a good friend, Matt Neal, who also co-runs .NET Oxford User Group with me. We even used to work together a few years back, which is where we first met. And coincidentally, we live in the same town and our kids even go to the same school. And we've had quite a few .NET Oxford planning meetings. And I'm putting planning meetings in air quotes there because we didn't do much planning, and it was in the pub before lockdown, obviously, with laptops and mostly geeking out over technology rather than planning anything to do with .NET Oxford.
Yeah.
Those were the days, and now we just do it over Zoom.
Well, yeah, I mean, I seem to recall us trying to steal the Wi-Fi from the pub that we weren't in so that we could sit in the pub that had better beer.
Yeah, the days when we could go to pubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I must actually apologise because Matt did insist that we both bring beer to this podcast recording. Now, I obviously pushed back really heavily on this one, but Matt insisted. So now I'm sat here with a lovely cold.
This is not how it went down. I seem to recall getting a message from you this morning for Adam Store-styled beer reminder.
I knew that was going to come back and haunt me. I just knew it. But I am now sat with a lovely cold bottle of Moretti, which is very nice. So, okay, fair enough. Matt's right. I didn't push back that hard. But yeah, seriously, a massive welcome to the show, Matt. It's awesome having you on.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. So it's just good to catch up, if anything else, to be honest, as well, isn't it? I think we've not spoken outside of .NET Oxford for a good few weeks now.
I know, yeah. Well, this can be our next .NET Oxford planning meeting, which isn't a .NET Oxford planning meeting, and we can pretend we're at the pub. We've both got beer, so it's all good. But I actually did a bit of a rubbish job introducing you then, because I didn't actually say what you do, other than getting me to drink beer, which...
Oh, what do I do? It's a really good question. I mean, I've recently changed what I'm doing to a certain degree after a great many years being an employee. I am now an employer of myself, which is fun. So I am a .NET developer, a consultant, solution architect, kind of whichever label I suppose you want to put on me. I run my own business now called Neal Consulting, specializing really in content managed solutions and service orientated architecture. That's kind of my jam. That's what I like doing and I'm very interested in at the moment. And also in that mix, I am a MVP for Kensco Content, which is a headless CMS that I very much like to use. And as you said, I again, air quotes, help you out with .NET Oxford and keeping that all up and running. And we've been doing that for, gosh, three years now. Yeah, three, nearly four. I don't know.
Over 4 years.
Doesn't time fly when you have a fun?
In one way, it feels like, how has it been 4 years already? But in another way, before that feels like a lifetime ago. Is it similar with kids, actually?
It is, but also I think last year doesn't really count. Last year, I mean, although I suppose we've managed to keep it going, most of last year is an absolute blur, I think. I mean, we're nearly at March now, so it's nearly been a year since we're all allowed to properly go out and play. And do things in a year since we were at the Story Museum or the St. Aldate's Conference Centre.
It's kind of interesting with it going virtual, where it's amazed me that it's just worked. I mean, we've had lots of people providing feedback saying, when you go back to a physical event, please have some aspect of being virtual so we can still attend.
Yeah, it's been really great. I mean, we had, a guy called Cam on, wasn't it, last week, all the way from Kentucky, I want to say.
Yeah, it was somewhere in the States. Yeah.
So yeah, somewhere over the water, and yeah, it's great. I think it's opened up the opportunity for a lot more people to join who wouldn't necessarily be able to, you know, make their way to St. Aldate's Conference Centre or the Story Museum or wherever it is we were hosting, and that's been really good. And yeah, I can see it's going to be a real challenge when we start having physical events again. How we keep people who are going to remain remote involved. And yeah, the conversations you and I were having with everyone after, I think, the last couple of meetups, just simple things like the prize draw. It works so well. For anyone who's been to .NET Oxford, they'll know that when we do physical events and we're running through meetup and we have this prize draw, it's an app that's drawing all of its data from the people who signed up in meetup.com and we just randomly select people for the prizes, whether it's a JetBrains license or a Manning ebook. And pre-lockdown, it was kind of 50-50 whether people who signed up on meetup.com would actually turn up. And I think we probably spent half the time just drawing people's name, going, no, Steve's not here. Okay, fine, next name. So actually, with the way we're doing it now, doing it through Zoom, the way that you've written and changed the code, it pulls from a list of attendees who are on the call. It's perfect. Absolutely perfect. So that's going to be a real challenge, both in terms of trying to engage two sets of people, a physical audience that are present, and potentially, if we manage to do it, also streaming it live. How do we involve live people in the draw in the same way as we do people who are in the room? It's going to be fun. But it's great. I'm so happy that it carried on working. I know quite a few meetups have really struggled, I think, with the online thing.
Yeah, well, even Azure Oxford, which I started the year before with, well, you know, James Wild. And when COVID started, we decided to see how .NET Oxford went virtually. And Azure Oxford, we just didn't start it back up again. So that's kind of another casualty of COVID, I guess.
I mean, I guess also, Azure Oxford was quite young. I don't know. I hang my head in shame. I didn't actually attend a single Azure Oxford yet. I hope to. I'm hoping you're going to start them back up again. But yeah, time is never my friend. So I never managed to find the time to do it.
Yeah, I know that feeling. I think also because I've now started this podcast as well, so there's .NET Oxford, the podcast, obviously work, kids and everything, so that might be even harder to resurrect Azure Oxford. But we'll see how things go when we can resume doing things again.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Hopefully not long now, touch wood. Don't jinx it. All of the wood in the house, touch the wood. Yeah, it's...
So moving on to CMSs.
Yes.
So I kind of was aiming to have multiple episodes talking about different CMSs in the .NET space. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few different ones now. And I thought, given that you're a Kentico MVP,
yes,
and we've already spoken about that, but we can talk more about that later as well, what better person to join me for a Kentico CMS geek out?
Yes, you get double the fun as well, because Kentico have obviously got two CMSs to pick from.
I didn't know that, to be honest.
Did you not? Oh, well, there we go. There's some extra stuff for me to tell you. Lovely. I thought I'd done that already, but clearly you and I don't have deep and meaningful conversations.
So is that the Kentico Connect headless thing?
Kentico Contents, yes. So Kentico Contents with a K is the headless CMS offering that they bought in a few years back. And then there is also Kentico Experience, which you will probably know by the name of Kentico EMS, which when we worked together back at Ridgeway, that's what we were using for the projects there.
Yes, yeah.
Kentico Experience is a .NET-based CMS, it's a more traditional CMS that you'd be used to compared to Kentico Content, which is the headless offering. So you can use whatever you want, a bit of Perl, a bit of PHP, whatever, a bit of .NET, obviously, so otherwise I wouldn't probably be using it quite so much, but yeah. It's quite fun having two different ones to choose from, that's for sure.
I didn't actually realise there were two different things. I thought they were all under the same product, so I didn't realise they were marketed as two different products. I do really like the idea of headless CMSs because there's lots of new shiny technologies, or maybe not that new, like you want to do things in React, Angular, mm-hmm. Vue, the latest .NET Core, on it's not .NET Core anymore, just .NET, .NET 5, and lots of these CMSs are kind of like using all the technologies. I remember when we used to work together at Ridgeway that Kentico was built on top of web forms. So we had, rather than using MVC, which I believe Kentico now supports,
yes,
we were using web forms, where just the idea of being able to build it in whatever you want, then I'm assuming you're just making an API call to get the content to render in your own way, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I first started using Kentico Content, it had a different name. I mean, it was bought in a few years ago, and it was originally called Kentico Draft. And for those who are more web inclined and in content management circles, it was roughly termed to be a competitor of something called Gather Content, which was really, for all intents and purposes, it is a simple CMS where you collate your content while you're building your full CMS, and then you would do a migration from Gather Content into your CMS. So all of the content editors could get going while all of the developers were playing table football and stuff and leaving everything till the last minute. But that's where kind of Draft came in. And it wasn't long before they thought, actually, this is just, it's a really nice lightweight CMS here. obviously that might not be the exact conversation that went on. For starters, it would have been in Czech rather than English, but some other things would have happened. And then eventually, instead of being called Kentico Draft, it became Kentico Cloud. And it was Kentico Cloud for a very long time. And then only in the last year or two, we've rebranded all of that to Kentico Content. But in those early periods, I mean, I was one of the first few people to build a site in it, because I got very excited rather too quickly about it, perhaps. And yeah, I mean, there was a REST API, and I was calling the API, getting some JSON back, and basically mangling some JSON in .NET. I think even in .NET Framework at the time, I don't think it was even .NET Core, to render my pages. And it was fine. And then we get to where we are now. There's actually a whole bunch of SDKs on top of that endpoint. So there's an SDK for .NET, there's an SDK for Java, JavaScript, and a few other bits and pieces that other people use. So it's quite a simplified editing experience. So if you can't find the exact SDK you want, you can just go and call the endpoints and do whatever you want with the endpoints and get your data back out of the CMS. So yeah, it's a seismic shift from what you were doing with me 5 years ago, I'm trying to remember.
We didn't start .NET Oxford straight away, and that's been going for over 4 years.
Yeah, so it must be. It's going to be at least 5 years.
Wow.
I reckon it's about 5.
And a lot of the listeners are thinking, hang on, you were doing web forms 5 years ago. Oh.
Yeah. So that was always a bit of a problem, if I'll be honest. And I think if you talk to any partner or developer who worked with what was called Kentico EMS back then, it was a major sticking point. You know, you could do MVC in it, but the whole product was really geared for web forms. It had this really beautiful tool in it. And I say beautiful because it's beautiful from a content editor's perspective, which they called the Portal Engine. And if you use purely the Portal Engine, you could genuinely build a reasonable website entirely inside a web interface using the Kentico EMS platform. Now, if you looked under the hood, then you know, the code that you were getting out wasn't great, and it wasn't massively performant. But the abilities, what I liked it for more as an architect or a consultant, was the ability to really spin up a very quick demo to someone. You could take someone's business requirements, and within a couple of hours, you could have a kind of a roughly working thing with you know, no code / low code solution to building a website. It was kind of like not quite like a Wix website, but it was pretty straightforward and easy. But you know, the downside of that was, yeah, it was web forms. You had a view state kicking about, and you had just, yeah, all the stuff that makes you shudder. It was all there, but it's all gone pretty much. It's gone now. So the latest version, Kentico 13, is MVC. Doesn't support the Portal Engine anymore. Some of the admin stuff is still web forms based, but whatever the customer of your website is going to see, that's now all MVC, and it is a lot quicker for it.
Nice. I've just realized, me saying about web forms 5 years ago, I'm going to get lots of hate mail now from developers that are still using it and not wanting to.
Well, if you start getting hate mail, just okay, tab services spaces, fire that back, get some trolls and some flame wars going on. It's all fine.
Yeah, tabs versus spaces, and dark mode versus light mode, Emacs versus Vim. There we go.
Oh, I got very, my first MVP summit, I got absolutely roasted by a couple of the people on the summit for not using dark mode on my laptop. I remember that.
That's completely fair enough.
Well, I think in hindsight, yeah, no, fair enough. But at the time, it was, yeah, it felt like a schoolboy. Made me feel foolish.
It's okay. For me saying that's fair enough, I'm going to get more hate mail. So,
yeah, that's it. I'm just queuing you up to fail, Dan. That's what it is.
Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.
So now that .NET is cross-platform, does that mean Kentico is also cross-platform?
In terms of the customer-facing website, yeah, sure, why not? There's no reason for it not to be. So with Kentico Experience, if you want to, I don't know, host it, write it on Mac, whatever you want to do, it's .NET 5, and you can get away with whatever you can get away with the .NET 5. The whole admin side, so Kentico Experience comes in two parts. You've got the website that you're going to serve to your customers, so whether that's just e-commerce or brochureware or whatever. And then we've got a whole admin site, which is, you know, where you control your content, where you manage your products and all that kind of thing. That is still, I think, I'm a little bit out of the loop on experience, if I'll be honest. But as far as I'm aware, the Experience admin site still needs to be hosted on Windows compatible hardware, software, even that one.
Can you spin it up in a Windows container?
Yes, you can spin it up in a container, I believe. Yeah.
You can still use like Docker and everything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't profess to say that from experience of having done it myself, but I have come across articles where it's been spun up in Docker containers quite happily. So, yeah, no, absolutely. Personally, I try to spend more of my time at the moment in Kentico Content. So Kentico Content is what I'm an MVP for now. So if you spoke to me this time last year, I would be telling you that I was a Kentico MVP. We just had like one umbrella MVP status for all Kentico developers, and we've split that now into two different groups because there are two very distinct products. So in part, you know, the requirements of being an MVP, one of them is to be certified on the products. And it was a little bit unfair having someone come in who was purely focused on Kentico Content, and then they'd have to learn and certify themselves in this kind of big monolithic CMS that takes a couple of years to learn just to kind of maintain the status. So it's kind of nice now that that's split into these two separate groups. So as I say, that's where I kind of spend most of my attention at the moment, trying to figure out the best way to use that as a platform.
With your MVP thing, I know that just this is a tangent, but I know you've spoken before about going to your MVP summit. I think it was in Brno. Is that right?
That's right, in Brno, yes.
Are they now doing that virtually?
So we had a few meetings last year because obviously there's a bit of a bug going around and we're not allowed to go anywhere.
Is there?
Apparently. So it's not good. And if anything, I think the Czech Republic have got it worse than we have, which takes some doing, I think, from what we all see in the news every day. So, yeah, we didn't get to do our physical meetup last year. So we had a few, I think two calls, kind of massive long calls, I think, over a period of a couple of days where we kind of caught up with the product team and other people. But it's not the same as being out in Brno and seeing people face to face, because I think I think you've not had an opportunity to do this either for your Microsoft MVP, have you? But if you manage to go to the physical summit and you get to not only attend the presentations and the discussions, you also then get to go and meet people and socialize with them and get to know them a bit better, I guess, outside of that work environment, which is always quite nice. And specifically, I think the Kentico MVP Summit, Brno itself is a lovely, lovely, lovely city. I'm a great fan of European cities anyway, but I think Brno is an often overlooked destination actually by people from the UK. I think it's the second largest city in the Czech Republic. It's like huge, and it's lovely, and it's got a big castle which is really steep. Don't run up that hill. It's very steep. That's my advice. If you ever go there and you go for a run, do not run up to the castle.
Is that going to be your dev tip?
It's my dev tip. That's it. Thank you very much. That's my dev tip. Don't run up the castle at Brno. If you're lucky, I'll find out the name of it. What's it called? Spielberg, something like that. Spielberg.
Very nice. I will include a link to that in the show notes so our listeners can have a look. Yeah, with the Microsoft MVP Summit, the very first one I was due to go to was the first one that got cancelled because of COVID. I was so looking forward to that, so I was really good.
Oh, man. Yeah. No, that's it. Where was that?
That was going to be in Seattle.
Seattle, nice. Yeah, that would have been good.
Taking the week off work, booked the flights, and then COVID hit.
Well, I'll tell you a story. Many, many years ago, when I worked for an agency called Domino, and we were building a website for Epson, you know, computer inks, etc., and printers, in fact, as it would happen. And we were using something called Microsoft Commerce Server, which was related to Microsoft Site Server, if you're old enough and unfortunate enough to remember both of those products. And it was the first site in Europe that was going to be using Commerce Server. We had Microsoft consultants helping us, a really great guy called Alfred Beinler helping us out. And I think he works with Google now. And we had these daily calls with the team in Redmond, the product team, about what we were doing and what we were building. And there was supposed to be a point where we were going to pack our little bags, as little junior web developers that we were at the time when I was young and my beard wasn't even there, let alone when it wasn't grey. And we were going to go out to Redmond and we were going to spend either a week or 2 weeks working directly with the product team to get this project over the line so that they could see what we were doing. You know, we were really hammering the product with some heavy duty usage. And then 9/11 happened. And instead of Redmond, we went to Reading. And as nice as the Microsoft Center is in Reading, in Thames Valley Park, it's not Redmond. So, hey ho. So there's another person who's not managed to go to Microsoft. But it was disappointing. A whole week just paid for by Microsoft went down the pan.
Yeah. I was quite impressed when they cancelled the physical MVP summit that they very quickly turned it into a virtual summit.
Yes.
This was obviously at the start of COVID, so they weren't used to Teams getting as much load as it gets now. But they turned it around very, very quickly. So that was quite impressive.
They've done really well, Microsoft, responding to this, I think. I mean, quite a few of the larger companies have responded really well to the situation we find ourselves in. But Microsoft, I think, have done particularly well. I mean, obviously they had some practice with .NET Conf and stuff like that from before, but yeah, nowhere on the scale that we're talking now.
So going back to Kentico, I remember when we worked
together
and I did a little bit of Kentico. We were creating like components, I think they were called web parts. And for the headless version, are you still dealing with web parts, but are you getting that back by JSON or something? How does that work?
No. So the way of thinking about content with a headless CMS is slightly different. I think up until recently, I would have basically told you, well, there's no real UI, you're just creating content. That's not strictly true anymore, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But really, the way I visualize it is that headless CMSs are really just a big bucket of stuff. So if you think of a more traditional CMS where you have maybe a content tree where you set up your root node is your home page, and then you have other nodes under there which will contain more pages and more pages, and each one of those nodes is a particular type and has particular fields. That's kind of your traditional CMS. And then on each one of those pages, maybe you'll have some kind of area where you can drag these web parts or widgets about. With a headless CMS, we don't kind of do that. It's all really more about structured content. And I think one of the key principles is we're not really talking just about a website. We're talking about omni-channel content. So it's content that you could be using on a website. You could equally be using it on your watch or your fridge or anywhere else that can kind of consume that content, a smart speaker, those sort of things. So the construct of that data is slightly different. Up until recently in content, you didn't really have the concept of, you know, navigating a structure of content in that way. You had content items and you have relationships between content items. So whether that's maybe a field that says, okay, I'm a field and I have linked content items in me. Those content items might be, for example, a related article or maybe a product or something like that. You would put those into a little bucket and that relationship is then created. With Kentico Content, there's also now a plug-on for it called Web Spotlight, which gives you two special content types, which are effectively for building a navigation tree. But you use that in conjunction with something else called the SmartLink SDK, which if you're writing a website, you're effectively putting a little bit of markup around the elements in your website and including a small JavaScript library. We use the SmartLink SDK to embed a small bit of additional data in the form of attributes in your HTML. A small JavaScript library is included on your page. And what that does is it kind of puts boxes around all of your content elements in the page when you're in preview mode. And then you can click on any of those boxes and it takes you straight into the content admin interface to edit that piece of content. And where this is nice is you've got this concept of a web spotlight with a home page and navigation elements. And you can then navigate that tree in the left-hand side on the content admin interface and get the preview mode of your website effectively in an iframe on the right-hand side. And you can see that content you click and you can start editing. So it kind of brings this more visual editing experience to the headless CMS, which a large majority of the time people are using it as some kind of web experience. So it's that kind of acknowledgement from Kensco that, okay, as much as the purist headless CMS would tell us that this is, it's just content and it could be any channel you want. We don't have to be delivering a website. It could be like a set of instructions for Alexa to go and tell you something. We know that we're using it a lot for websites, so this kind of sits there and gives us that much richer experience so that the content editors get much more instant feedback on what they are creating within content.
That's really nice. Just, I kind of pictured like a headless CMS. Here's an API, go sort yourself out. Mm-hmm. Where having that tooling around, being able to visualize the content just sounds brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, content's had a preview mode for quite a while. So we've been able to set up preview mode and effectively provide a URL structure or a slug for a content type. When you define the content type to your page type, whatever it is, you can say, well, the preview URL for this will be this. And there'll be a couple of bits of kind of macro in there, whether that's the item's code name or something like that, that can then tell the content interface, well, if I click preview on this page, what it's going to do, it's going to take the metadata about this document plus that preview URL, mash the two together, and then try and serve you that page. So you can see that page as it would look. Now, that all gets a little bit more sticky when you're talking about something like a static site, but if you're building it with .NET in a server-rendered environment, that means your page is coming back straight away with the content changes you're making. So it's really nice. And I think the web spotlight is just that extra notch up. I'm kind of sitting here, I really want to just turn my computer around and show it to you, because it's really, really quite a beautiful thing to look at when it's all set up correctly. In terms of what that offered when it came out, that was certainly the only headless CMS doing something like that I'm aware of. And it's quite a game changer for that enterprise client to be able to see and visualize your content as you're editing it. Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, to say, you know, it's the focus of Kensco Content is very much, you know, it's enterprise clients. It's people with some serious amounts of content to serve across multiple projects. And the whole concept of the headless CMS from Kensco's point of view really is this centralized hub of all of your content. So rather than having various different systems dotted around your estate, you've got all of your content in one place and you can serve it around in whichever form you need it to. So the skill is in not thinking about a piece of content as a page. It's about thinking of as a piece of content as a tangible thing. So this is a product. What do I ever need to know about a product? And you look at all the attributes it should have, and it's not necessarily an attribute that you might want to put on a page. It's just an attribute that is useful about that product.
So from a testing point of view, so if you're adding automated tests, mm-hmm. because it's headless, would you just use the tooling you would use if you weren't using a CMS, or does Kensco have tooling to help out with this?
You can just use normal tooling. I'm going to have to stick my hand up here. I haven't written too many unit tests around content, primarily because I'm mostly sitting writing things with static sites. So most of the stuff that I've done with content has been with Gatsby and more recently with something called Static, which I think you're familiar with its predecessor of YAM.
Yes, yeah. Well, we use that for .NET Oxford, the website.
Yes, yes. So when I'm kind of using stuff like that, I tend not to really think about writing unit tests. I actually default really into, if I want to try something out and test something works properly, just spinning over to LinkPad and having a little play about in LinkPad and then trying stuff out and making sure I'm happy with it and then popping it back into my solution. So as it happens, I recorded a video over the last couple of weeks of just a quick whistle-stop tour into how to use content with LinkPad, just so if anyone else isn't already doing it and is a .NET dev, then they can kind of get on the bandwagon and have a play with LinkPad. I think you and I are equally big fans of LinkPad, and I have yet to listen to your last podcast, which is LinkPad themed.
Oh, definitely. That was amazing, having Joe on talking about LinkPad, the author of LinkPad.
Were you fanboying hard?
I was, definitely. I think I even said, I mentioned about being LinkPad's biggest fanboy in the intro talk to the episode. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a good episode. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
You actually sent me a link to that video, which I don't think you've published yet. And I was meant to watch some point today, but I didn't have a chance. But we will definitely include that in the show notes.
No worries. Well, I'm hoping to get that published, hopefully by the end of this week. That's my plan. This week is not necessarily going according to plan. It's the first YouTube video I've created ever that's more than just me recording a few clicks of a mouse. And the editing experience took me a bit longer than I expected, through fumbling my way through Lightworks to eventually submitting and downloading Adobe Rush instead to do my editing. But yes.
Yeah, I remember the very first time I did a YouTube video. It was one of the Azure Advent calendars. I think it was a couple of years ago. And I found exactly the same as you. I would start it and then I think you know it's recording. So you kind of end up, no, I didn't say that quite right. I'm going to start again. And when I first started doing it, I was actually stopping the recording, restarting it, where now I kind of would just stop and start again and then cut it out later.
It was a hard process, definitely a hard process. I think part of my problem is that I will spend too long trying to make something absolutely perfect. And I think probably, but maybe this is more of a dev tip than anything else, but don't ever try to record a video that's more than a few minutes long as if you're presenting it live to a room full of people. It will go bad from just the kind of action man eagle eyes trying to read writing that's on a copy of notepad right in front of your web camera, due to stuttering or stopping or forgetting what you're talking about and trying to cover up really obvious mistakes. It just makes the editing experience really horrible. You're better off just firing in short bursts straight at the camera, pause, leave a break, and do the next one. It's fine.
This is the thing I like about podcast editing. So it's audio only and you can cut out, and it's really hard to tell when you're chopping ums and ahs out. But when you're doing a video as well, especially if it's a webcam, then you can see it on YouTube videos quite often. You'll see the frame jump where they're editing. And the difference between a raw podcast recording that we're doing now and what we publish would be quite like night and day difference. And when I used to listen to podcasts before starting my own podcast, I didn't realize how much difference editing made.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, we were talking about all sorts of crazy programs for... Who was it? Someone mentioned, I'm sure it was in one of the post.net Oxford chats, about a piece of software that could just find the ums and ahs for you. It would like transcribe the whole audio stream, and then you could just go back and delete the words you didn't want. Whoever it was said, and the next thing was that it could also, if you typed in a few new words, it could figure it out and create the new word for you. And then we started getting into the realms of deep fakes and, you know, basically getting someone to record a massive audio stream and then just deleting it all and putting your own text in. Could we do it?
Yeah, so it was called Descript.
That's it.
And I have tried it once. And
was it good?
The UX was a bit funky, but I'm sure if you spend a bit of time learning it, then it's extremely powerful. So I probably need to give it another go. But yeah, you get the automatic transcribed text. You can edit it, remove words. You can add words, and it'll automatically use machine learning to listen to your voice and try and automatically insert those words. It does sound insane. But to be honest, I actually quite enjoy manually editing. It's quite satisfying taking like the raw audio and editing it and making it sound much more seamless.
If you've got a good tool, yes. If you've got a terrible tool, I can imagine that being painful. So the things I was doing with this video, the difference between the editing experience in Rush and Lightworks was phenomenal. I mean, Lightworks was a massively powerful tool, but it felt as if Rush was better at guessing what the hell I was trying to do at one point in time. And it was like when I was trying to trim a clip to where I stopped saying or after a period of silence, it felt like it was snapping to the right place for me, so I could just let it go and crack on. So it's quite a nice experience to do that. But taking back to the question about unit testing with Kentico Content, what I do keep on meaning to try out, and I haven't yet, is the library that somebody mentioned on Tuesday last week. Was it by the guys who do Netlify?
It was, I think it was Adam Storr mentioned it, and he's apparently going to do a lightning talk on it at Donald Oxford in April. And it's, I can't remember the name of it, but it's by Just Eat.
That's it, yes. Let's see if I can find it. Just Eat. It's called HTTP client interception. Yeah, it's a library which will basically intercept HTTP requests that are made with HTTP client, and then you can take that request and replay it and repeat it or intercept it or do effectively do what you will with that request. The thing that I want to try with it really is to spin up a little simple .NET application. And I don't know whether under the hood the SDK is using HTTP client. I kind of rather hope it is. But I want to see my requests go off to content, bring back some data, and then just save that. And next time I run it, just intercept that client and run it locally instead. So, you know, one of my bugbears with a headless CMS development environment is if, like this ever happens these days, if I'm sat on a plane, I tend to not have that great connectivity to the headless CMS endpoint. So it'd be really nice to have all, you know, kind of pre-recorded all of my messages and be able to effectively replay them in the same way you would with ngrok or something like that, just kind of replay a message back, except the way it works is to just intercept that request in the first place and go, I can see you're trying to get to content types for your CMS. You've done that before. You've told me what you want to return. So here's the payload. I'll just give you that payload back instead of going out to the outside world. So it looks pretty cool. And I definitely want to play with it. I think pretty much everyone on the Zoom call, when we were talking about that, just basically went quiet. And you could just about hear a few clacking of keyboards while everyone was having a look at the description on GitHub of this library. So definitely on my very long list of things to look at is the HTTP client interception library.
Yeah, definitely. I find that when I'm doing integration tests, I quite often have a something repository and where the interface would just be calling out into like doing that HTTP call. And then I would mock out that repository, where it would be much nicer if my integration test went that step further and included the I whatever repositories concrete class as part of the integration test and only mocked out that final HTTP call.
Yeah, and this is what it feels like it does. So I mean, you know, thinking about something like a headless CMS, you're still, you know, somewhere you've got to maintain a big chunk of JSON for each type of request you're making. But that's okay. That's not so bad. I mean, it doesn't feel like that would be too arduous to recreate that every once in a while as you change your schema and your content model.
If that library didn't work, you could probably quite easily knock up a local .NET web API and just have that as a proxy effectively, which just caches the content.
I mean, yeah, that's another option, definitely. It's not as much fun though, right?
true. So in quite a few of your tweets recently, I've heard this term Jamstack, and I know you wanted to talk a bit about this in this episode.
Yeah, so Jamstack is when you get a lot of pancakes and you stack them up. You just go for some strawberry conserve in between them. It's very nice. You should try it.
Can you have peanut butter as well?
Well, that's not jam, is it, Dan? So no, you can't.
I know, you've got to mix it up a bit, surely.
No, that would be a sin. I think, I don't know, peanut butter on a pancake, would that even work? I don't know.
Then we'll be getting into, can you put pineapple on it and stuff? And there's the whole pineapple on pizza debate.
Oh,
and
Jesus, we're back to tabs versus spaces again.
Anyway.
Let's not go there. So, yeah, so Jamstack is something, it's actually been around for quite a while. And I know you and I have had a few little conversations about the concept of it. Jamstack basically is JavaScript APIs and markup. It's the concept of using JavaScript to deliver functionality to your website. Now, quite often you'll see that sites built in Jamstack are what we consider static sites. And that in itself is an interesting term as to what really makes a static site. So from my aged past, when I think about a static site is something that I would have written on like a Spark system or something using Vi back in 1996 that had no functionality apart from some drop-down lists and some rudimentary JavaScript. And that JavaScript did nothing at all that wasn't already on that page. That to me was what a static site. So I know when I first saw people talking about Jamstack and static site generators, I kind of dismissed it out of hand, if I'll be honest. I was like, yeah, I wrote those things back in the day. I mean, even as late as maybe 2000 or something like that, I was writing static site generators using ASP Classic. Nice. To take, you know, dynamic sites and go, well, this user's not logged in. They don't need dynamic content. So every day we'll just generate a flat version of the same site and save some processing power on the servers. Yeah, now Jamstack is quite a lot more than that. It's much more functional. So you're starting to look primarily at the JavaScript world. So that's where most of the action with Jamstack kind of lies, with a lot of work being done with things in Node. You've got Next.js, Gatsby is one that a lot of people have heard of. These are basically static site generators, usually based on something like React or Vue.js, etc., that you create some static markup, but everything's just wrapped up in React components or Vue components that can then go off and dynamically recreate new bits of content, potentially go off to another API, draw more content in, etc., to your page to give you that dynamic working website. As I said, the concept of what static is kind of an interesting question. I think someone summed it up quite nicely that a static page is one where the web server doesn't really have to do anything apart from give you a file. That's a really nice way to think about what a static page is. Now, whether that page is then a bit more dynamic by the time it gets to a client is a whole other story. But just like getting the markup from the server to the client just requires practically zero effort. It's just pick up a file and serve it. The most you've got to do is return a 404, perhaps, if the file doesn't exist. It's quite a good approach.
So just the J in Jam, you said it was JavaScript. Does that refer to client-side JavaScript, server-side, or both?
So, yeah, my interpretation of that is it's client-side. As I say, you know, Gatsby and Next.js, they're all written effectively, you know, JavaScript or TypeScript or the likes, but they don't need to be. You know, you're creating static pages. So, as I mentioned earlier on, static, the demon child of YAM, I don't know what you want to call it, but the successor of YAM, I suppose, Dave Glick's wonderful project, is a .NET static site generator. So, and I'm using it to generate a static site. I'm in the process of rewriting my site at the moment. I moved it over from .NET Core to Gatsby a couple of years ago because I wanted to have a play with Jamstack and a play with Gatsby, and that seemed like as good an opportunity as any other. And now I want to go back to .NET because I like .NET. Even more excitingly, I realized, and I don't know when this became a thing, that you can do .NET builds in Netlify, which is where I host my website at the moment. So, yeah, having wasted a quarter of an evening in Azure DevOps building my pipeline and testing it and then adding connectors to connect to Netlify to push my website from the output of my Azure DevOps build to Netlify CLI to publish it to Netlify, I realized I could just do .NET run in Netlify, and that does the same thing in literally seconds compared to a couple of minutes. So in answer to your question, the J in Jamstack is the client side, which then gives you another interesting question: is does it need to be J at all? Could it be a B? Could you have a BAM stack and use Blazor?
BAM stack. With the concept of static then, like with Jamstack, I might think of a React application, a .NET API, which fits those acronyms, but my application might not be a static website. It might be a normal Spark application. Does a normal Spark application using React or Angular, is that still Jamstack? Or
I think it depends who you talk to. I mean, my personal take on that is it doesn't need to be static. I think the benefits of it being static are many. I mean, static is a lot quicker to get to your endpoint. There's no doubt about that. The downside of static can be that you have to build your site almost completely every time you build it. Whereas, you know, with a server-rendered site, you might make a request for your contact page and you render your contact page and off you go, everything's good and everything that's up to date is rendered nicely. If you do that with a static site and you want to change something on your content page, you kind of have to render a lot more content to create that static file, to maybe update your footers or your navigation on every single page that exists or something like that. You can have a little bit more lag between publishing a content change and having your content live, but it's static once it's done and it is blisteringly fast. So your Google Lighthouse score will start to go through the roof because the performance is nice and fast. So you have to kind of bear that in mind. But for sure, from my personal opinion, there's nothing really stopping you having it as being a server-rendered page. The Jamstack is all about the client and how you keep that page relevant and what you do once you're there.
Nice. You mentioned about, like, we've mentioned about .NET a few times and .NET CMSs. Now, I know when I used the YAM you've already mentioned for the .NET Oxford website, I used it because it's .NET, so that's cool. I'll use .NET. I'm a .NET developer. But then I found out I didn't actually need to do any .NET because I was writing Markdown, CSS, and JavaScript because I wasn't actually extending it at all.
Yes.
So I know when I did the website for this podcast, I used Hugo, and I didn't find I was doing anything differently because I wasn't writing .NET anyway in YAML. Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you start doing more stuff and extending it out, that you are doing much more .NET?
Well, I think that's kind of the nail on the head. Most of the platforms you get, you go to Gatsby, you'll spin up a new site, and it'll be based on static files. The basic introduction to static, which is .NET, is going to be based on static files. I think that the boilerplate by default with static is a lot more sparse, I think, than something like Gatsby might give you. But you've basically got a markdown file for some content and the front matter at the top of the markdown file to find some of the metadata for that page. There's not a lot of coding to do around that. So most of your biggest challenges is setting out your views or how you want your actual markup to look. When you start using a CMS of any variety, whether headless or otherwise, you're using a much more structured set of content. So yes, you find yourself writing more .NET. Static is a great example. Actually, it's been a quite nice little learning curve in a way. It works in a slightly different way that I'm not used to insofar that everything's pipelines. And pipelines are all built of modules, and all of the modules are immutable, and you're passing in a collection of stuff and getting a collection of stuff back out, and then you pass it into the next one, and the next one, and the next one. So there's a little bit of a challenge into how you structure that data when you have dependencies between pipelines. So let's say, for example, you want to have an article listing. You've got a pipeline called article listing, but there'll have been a pipeline called article, which has already rendered all of your article pages. But you make your article listing pipeline dependent on the article pipeline so that all of those documents are there ready to go. So you don't have to go and get them again. You've already got all of that content sat down as effectively a collection of metadata that you process. So for sure, doing a lot more .NET code than if I was just looking at markdown files and spitting them out onto the page.
Nice. Yeah, I think for static websites, I've only done the very, very basics.
And I think for most people, that's fine. And it's that good introduction. If you're not trying, the whole reason that I'm using a headless CMS is because I want to play with a headless CMS in it. And for what I do, for my profession, my 15 years, 20 years, man and boy, as a web developer, it suits me to be using a headless CMS to try out and different techniques and see how I can build something. If all I wanted to do was create a blog site, yeah, sure, Markdown. I mean, it's pretty easy, right? But I'm playing with other things and I'm doing other stuff with my CMS. So I'm trying out the web spotlight features. I'm trying out the SmartLink SDK. I'm going to hopefully soon be trying out, there's a new audit feature that Content have just brought in, so I can look at the audit history of a piece of content. We've got collections where I can limit different users to only editing different types of or different areas of content within my content bucket, which is awesome. Again, for enterprise clients, how amazing is that you can say this group of people, you can only edit this content, whereas historically it's been you've got a login, excellent, off you go and change whatever content you like. Oh, you've broken something, excellent, well done. So, we can tie that down a little bit more. So because I've got access to all of those features, I can then play with those with my own website. And that means that then when a client's asking me about them, I can actually help them a little bit more.
Nice. So before we move on to dev tips, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
Oh, did I? I suppose that there's one more thing which I'm going to be doing a lightning talk on soon as well about sustainability of the web. This is another reason that I'm quite a fan of static sites. It's part of a wider conversation, I think, that a lot of people don't really think about, which is the actual impact of, as developers, what we create and what we consume. And we don't really think about it. And this actually all came about in my mindset for a couple of reasons. One, I read an article about the cost of storing data and realized how many unread emails my wife had, and was just scratching my head at what the carbon footprint was of her inbox at any particular moment in time. And the other was a chap I used to work with. I can't remember whether you guys crossed paths at Ridgeway as well, a guy called Rob Simpson, who really, really good kind of front end dev. And he's done some really, really great posts recently about kind of sustainability of the web, even down to just serving. I was about to say low-grade images. I don't mean low-grade images, just really low-fidelity images on a website. And then if the customer really wants to see a more detailed image, then you can click on it and get a bit more detail and just saving the bandwidth and the transmission of content. A really, really nice infographic by a company called Luminary, based out in Australia from a couple of years ago, that kind of highlighted with a very Australian kind of angle, in terms of it was Australian people rather than it had lots of pictures of kangaroos and cool cats, about the cost of, you know, streaming a video, downloading a web page. Like, you know, if you stream this video on Netflix at high definition, it's the equivalent to driving a car this many miles. And it's a really, really interesting concept. And then when you kind of look at it in terms of a website, if I've got a website that doesn't change very often, yet I'm constantly consuming database resources, CPU cycles to go and render a piece of content and process that content, put it out as markup, and then serve it back to the client, how much more power am I using, and what's the impact of that compared to just going, here's your HTML file, thank you very much, off you go. And, you know, processing all of that data once versus processing it, you know, 5, 10, 15, 100,000 times a day, the actual impact of that is going to be pretty high. I think the stat I looked at the other day is that something around 9 to 19%, I can't remember which it is, of the energy consumption globally is basically communications. And that's quite a daunting amount, really. I think when you look at the internet, it's about to start rivaling air travel. Probably has rivaled air travel in the last 12 months because no one's allowed to go anywhere. But it's just kind of quite an interesting thing to think about, the impact of what we do as developers on the environment that you don't really think about, but actually it's worth kind of paying some attention. So if you come along to .NET Oxford next month, assuming that this has gone live by then hopefully you that's not next month, is it? It's April.
Yes, April.
Is it? That's right, yeah. So if anyone wants to come along to .NET Oxford in April, then hopefully I'll be a little bit more knowledgeable about the subject and can give you some more stats and about why we should be a bit more careful with what we do from a web sustainability perspective.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I take the technology around us for granted. Mm. And if I go for a drive, then I do think about the impact. But then I don't consider that, like now I'm sat here with three monitors on. Do I need three monitors on? All this kind of thing.
Do you ever need three monitors on there?
Yes. But it does raise a valid point, though. I could turn one off when I'm not using it. So I think it's quite important. You're mentioning Rob Simpson before. I do remember Rob. And if he doesn't mind, we can share his blog posts on the show notes too.
I'm sure he won't mind, but I'll drop him in a DM.
Cool.
And see if he's up for that. I'm sure he'll be fine with that. Bit of publicity. It's all good.
Nice. So shall we do dev tips?
Ah.
Yes, I got my beep.
Oh, the beep. You're so happy. Can that be my dev tip? It's just a big, long beep.
I said to you before, I've been dying since I started the podcast to be able to put a beep in, but now I can. That's awesome.
I think I might have something saved up in Notion. Let me just go through. Actually, do you know what? That could just be my dev tip. Use Notion like it's going out of fashion. Actually, Dan, it's something you introduced me to a few months back, is Notion. If you go to notion.so, it's a wonderful app that I've got installed on my machine. It's on my phone. You can use it as a web client, etc. How best to describe what Notion is? It's kind of like OneNote on steroids for nerds is how I would describe it, I guess. I use it for taking notes for anything. You can create code blocks really easily. So the video that I just used, all of my notes and all of my prep for that was done in Notion. Just very quickly copying and pasting things into Notion and reorganizing content and turning things into pages and putting tables and Kanban boards. It's just a really good dumping ground. But unlike OneNote, where you kind of dump stuff and it kind of stays in a bit of a random mess, it's really, really easy in Notion to just kind of reorganize everything and drag things about, because every single paragraph, every bullet point is its own little content item. So you can just move it around and drag it. It's really, really good thing to use if you need to take notes quickly about what you're doing. That will help you out.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for that. I live my life in Notion, personal stuff, work stuff. I just put everything in there. I would probably just describe it as a wiki effectively, but a wiki on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, it's something on steroids. Yes. Basically, it's got a steroids abuse issue that it needs to deal with perhaps, but it's a really, really good tool.
Cool. I will include a link to that in the show notes too. So my dev tip is basically to heavily learn and use keyboard shortcuts for everything you can. very recently had a work colleague who's just joined the team I'm working on, and they commented that I was blushing when he said this, but that they've never seen anyone code or move around the IDE as fast as I can. Now, I'm really not saying this to brag or anything, because that's not me at all, but the only reason I'm pretty quick coding is because I've spent a lot of time learning keyboard shortcuts to quickly refactor code and move around the IDE. And this is something anyone can learn, though. It's just that most devs don't. So my dev tip is to do a bit of Googling for keyboard shortcuts for your IDE and favorite apps, print out a cheat sheet or something, and just practice them until they become firmly fixed in your muscle memory, and then learn some more.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good tip as well. I've just thought of another one, which is very, very useful. It's not really development, it's just kind of a general tip. So as with most people, I'm using Zoom a lot at the moment, and I'm using Teams a lot. And I was getting a bit annoyed, actually related to keyboard shortcuts, that the keyboard shortcuts for Zoom and Teams were different for muting my microphone. So this is a two-part tip. Part number one, just go and make all the keyboard shortcuts for mute the same. So instead of scrabbling about, you can just quickly, you always know, I don't know, Alt-Shift-M is mute. Great, there we go. Mute and unmute, it's always the same in Teams and Zoom. I took it a step further. I've got a Logitech MX Anywhere mouse, and I have a special little extra button above my scroll wheel, which I have then mapped to that keyboard shortcut. So whichever one of those apps I'm in, I literally just tap a button to mute and unmute, and it sorts me out, and I don't have to panic and scramble around and look for the active window and click on the little button. It's all good.
Very nice. One thing I do like in Zoom, which I don't think Teams support, is you can just tap the space key to toggle whether you're muted or not. And they've just recently changed it. It used to be if you held it down whilst the space key was held down, it would do the opposite. So if you were muted, it would unmute you, or vice versa. Well, last time I tried it, it became a toggle. So I think they must have changed it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's interesting, because it actually used to be quite helpful that you could just hold space down. I used to use that quite a lot. I think I'd probably get myself into trouble in quite a few calls now if that toggles it. some choice language going, oh, good, well done, excellent. I've just lost a client. Yeah. Oh, dear.
So where is the best place that our listeners can go to learn more about Kentico and Jamstack?
So, well, Jamstack, there's a whole website just dedicated to Jamstack. If you go to, I believe it's just jamstack.org. Let me just double check. On my slow internet. Yeah, there we go. So jamstack.org, you can go there. There's a whole site about Jamstack and why it's called Jamstack and when it became called Jamstack. Spoiler alert, we were doing it before it was called Jamstack. that's all fine. But Jamstack was a very nice way to explain it all and give it a name. If you want to find out more about Kentico content, please go to content.ai, and that's where you can pretty much find out everything you want to know about why you should use it, what it is, different solutions, pricing, links to the Learning Hub. There's a whole GitHub community that you can get to from that site as well, which has more information. You can then flow through and get to the Kentico GitHub repository, where they keep a lot of their SDKs and code that just runs in open source. So you can go and have a look and see what they do, which is pretty nice. And I am going to write an article at some point soon where all of the .NET resources that you might want for getting up to speed with Kentico content will be. I just haven't written it yet. And it's not very exciting when it's just bullet points in Notion. So I will make that nicer and better. And also, I can give you a link, Dan, if you want to put it in the show notes, that will also give people an extended trial. So normally you get like 30 days or something for free. And I can give people an extended version of that with my MVP hat on. So people can try that out. And I think it's a 3-month trial instead of a 1-month trial. So I'll give you a link for that if you want to pop it in the notes.
Very nice. Cool. So a big, massive thank you for joining us. It's been really amazing having you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been nice to catch up with you and just basically record our chat. I wonder how many we could have done of these if you'd already had a podcast. No, it's been good. It's been good.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. A quick reminder that this podcast is sponsored by Everstack, which is my own company providing software development and consultation services. For more information, visit everstack.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do help spread the word on social media. I normally use the hashtag #unhandledexception, and I can be found on Twitter at Dracan, D-R-A-C-A-N, and my DMs are open. And my blog is danclark.com. and has links to all my social stuff too. And of course, we will include links to all the things we've mentioned today in the show notes, which can be found on unhandledexceptionpodcast.com.